Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
The Price of Valor by Susan May Warren. What price will you pay to save the ones you love? Hamilton Jones lost his wife during a border skirmish in Ukraine. As a Navy SEAL, he was following strict orders, but by the time his tasks were completed, his wife had disappeared, presumed dead. Now, 10 years later, a girl claiming to be his daughter shows up with a dire message from his supposedly deceased wife. Ham knows he will stop at nothing to find his wife and bring her home. Sina Kincaid was kidnapped by rebels while serving as an interpreter in Ukraine. She has spent the past decade secreting out valuable information about Russian assets in the U.S. to her CIA handler. But when she is discovered as an operative, she knows she must send her daughter to Ham for safekeeping. She's ready to give her life for her country, but she can hardly expect Ham to rescue her after breaking his heart. When Ham discovers the reason Sine has kept her distance, he must choose between love for his wife and love for the nation he has vowed to protect. Will he save the many or the few?
Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm Sarah Hemmerker, your host, and I'm so glad you joined me. Today I'm talking with Susan May Warren. She's the USA Today bestselling author of more than 65 novels with more than 1 million books sold. And I'm very excited that we're going to get to talk about writing romantic suspense. So welcome to my show, Susan.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
So, you've written a lot of books.
Yeah.
So, that's a lot. What do you think is the hardest part of coming up with fresh ideas for your romantic suspense? Do you find that you kind of recycle them? I know there's only like 7 plots in the whole universe, but right? But how do you make your books, seem fresh and interesting?
Well, it's always about the setting and the characters, and then, of course, the trope. And you're right, there are only really 7 plots in the world, but there's many, many different kinds of tropes. And tropes are, secret identity and, different, lost brothers or, twins or, amnesia or whatever it is. You have that sort of trope to pick from. But what I try to do is I usually go from a scenario. I like to ask, what if? So I look around my world and I say, oh, what if you met someone on the plane who was going into the witness protection program and they told you about it? What would you do? Or what if you met someone who, if you thought you saw someone that was dead, would you follow them and, find out who they were?
Right.
Sort of thing. So I like to just look at scenarios like that. And what I try to do is every character is unique, of course, and so their story is unique. So you could take a mistaken identity plot, for example, and put it with any character, and that character, the uniqueness of that character will determine the plot. So it would be a very different kind of story than, if it was a different character. So in that way, you tropes can stay fresh because of the characters, and then you add the setting, and you say, okay, where does this story take place, Alaska or Hawaii or the Keys or Italy or wherever, and that adds a uniqueness to it. And then, of course, the author's own personal bents, things that they like to write about, themes that are prevalent in their lives or their stories, themes that make sense for that particular story. So all these ingredients, make for a different cookie every time you stir it up.
Yeah, and I find that I love the what if. I'm always, I read a news article, well, what if this happened? Mm-hmm, I've learned to keep most of those to myself. My family's like, what are you talking about, Mom?
It's fun to kind of try it out on people. What if this? And if their eyes sort of open and their eyebrows raise, you're onto something. And if they're like, whatever, they're like, oh, okay, that dies.
Yeah, maybe not. Or though, sometimes, though, I'm in conversation with someone and they'll say something and I'll be like, huh, and I'm like, okay, I can't just like totally lose that thread, but I really want to say, thank you, I need to go right now. You gave me a great a great what if scenario. I think that's what I love about being a writer is the way we're able to satisfy that curiosity itch, right? You know, I mean, you're interested in something and I can go explore it.
Yeah, I love that. The research of finding a new world is so much fun. New places, new careers, new kinds of, you know, thought processes, all these kind of things are so interesting. That's my favorite part is, I think next to the story world where I get to go to, say, Italy or Hawaii or the Keys or wherever it is that I place the story, finding out about someone's profession is so intriguing to me, you know, and a lot of my people are, you know, sort of tough and rumble kind of people. So, you know, they're a lot of search and rescue people, but I've had bull riders and I've had pilots and I've had, you know, boat captains and all sorts of things. And so, you know, I have to go research that. And that's really tough.
Yeah, I know. I sometimes I think of all these career choices I could have made. I could have done.
You get to sort of become that when you're writing, right? Because you get to carry on the character, and you're like, for a little season, I'm a, you know, a bull rider. For a little season, I'm a smoke jumper, you know, whatever.
Right, right. So, and with writing romantic suspense, I mean, people die. They have to. But I find that I'm always a little, and I wouldn't say hesitant, but I'm always a little like, I feel a little weird sometimes researching how to kill people. You know?
Yeah. I hear you. I don't actually, so in my romantic suspense, I don't like to kill people per se. So what, you know, my books are more adventure oriented, so I don't have to have a villain that comes in and does terrible things to people, but I do have people die. So I have to research, okay, if you fell, how could you die? If you, you know, that sort of thing. So my researchers are often, how do you live? So they end up being hurt, and then my people have to come in and save them. And so I always have to figure out, how would I save this person, both physically and, well, physically, you know, both like with their body, and then how do you get them out, you know, of the wilderness.
Right.
So I have a more pleasant side. I think it is fairly easy to kill someone just in a, you know, sort of everyday way, you know, you go fall off a cliff or you get in a car accident or whatever, but having to figure out how to save them has been really a good, fun challenge for me.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. It's almost if we have to be doctors and EMTs and rescuers, because you're always like, okay, so if this happens to my character, can they get up? Do they have to stay down? Mm-hmm. What are they, you know, because you want it to be realistic. You don't want people who live, you know, who are, you know, emergency room doctors to go, well, that's not possible. I mean, you want to stretch it a little bit, because we do have that literary license to play with the reality a little bit, but we want to make it as close to the truth. Yeah, a little bit. As close to the truth as possible, because writing books is not like TV shows, right?
No, and people are much more forgiving than a TV show, because they're like, oh, it's just TV. But when you write a book, if you don't get it right, people will write to you, and they will say, you know, this could never happen or whatever. And so I actually have a team of people that I refer to, search and rescue personnel, I have firefighter friends, you know, people like that, that I can say, okay, look at this. Would this work? Is this scenario work? You know, and they would they'll tell me, oh, tweak this and it'll work. Or, you know, if you just add this, or maybe give this more time or something. And then that really helps me get it right. Because I otherwise I know I will hear from people. I have a lot of search and rescue people that read my books, and they would write to me and say, oh, this isn't correct. That's terrible. So I'm very fortunate. I've kind of assembled over the years this panel of people that I can go to and say, okay, what's right? And then, of course, I have a ton of books. You know, I have search and rescue textbooks that I've gotten over the years, and that helps me a lot to figure out what's going to happen.
Right, and I think that, you know, the more accurate we can make our books, the more our readers will enjoy them. I mean, we've all read books where we're like, that's just not possible, because of what our own personal knowledge is on that. Or just, you know, I've had, you know, well, just let's not talk even about TV shows set. I live outside of Washington, D.C., set in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that's just not possible. But when I read, you're right, I'm more forgiven with TV because I know they have more limitations on shooting and scenes and stuff. But for books, I'm like, sometimes I can tell that the author just didn't even bother to Google the Washington area metro system. You know, and realize that that's not how it works.
Right, right. If it's in the U.S., I think an author should actually go there and experience it because there's nothing that beats firsthand knowledge, you know.
Yeah.
If not that, then find somebody that lives in the area. I mean, and now it's so easy to do that. You go on Facebook and you say, does anyone live in the D.C. metro area? And have you ever ridden on a subway? So anyway, it's and people love sharing their information, I found. You know, if you ask somebody information about something, you'll get about four times the amount of stuff than you need. So it's always a good thing. People love to talk about their lives. So asking people is always a good idea.
Right, and then you kind of get that buy-in to your writing, too. You know, because I've done that. I've asked friends I've known who know this piece of information, or I think that they might. And I'm like, hey, can you help me out? And they're like, oh, great. What are you working on? You know, what are you writing? You know, it just kind of, they like to feel that they're involved in your writing. And of course, as an author, I want their expertise.
Right. That's exactly right. So it is a win-win to ask questions and to. I've sat on planes with people before and found out about their lives. And remember this one guy is a firefighter in New York City. I sat on a plane with him, and I was able to just ask him tons of questions afterwards and became good friends. So that was really fun.
Great. I need to, I know. I'm a little shyer to chat people up on a plane, but I love that idea. Oh, I've thought about it, but I'm like, I'm a little too introverted for that. But Facebook I can ask.
Yes. There you go. That's a good way to do it, too.
So, you know, as a writer, you probably read a lot. So, so what are your favorite type of books? Is it the kind of books that you write? Do you have a secret, affinity for biographies?
Well, when I'm researching a novel, I'm all about memoirs, and crazily, I love self-published memoirs because they're pretty raw and they're pretty honest. So I read a lot of those while I'm researching something. That's like my little trick. But when I'm reading for relaxation, if I'm just starting something, I'll read a novel to get me in the mood, like a Lynette Easton or Danny Petrie or Irene Hannon or Terry Blackstock or Glenn Coble or Robin Carroll, you know, just all sorts of different authors that will help me get in the mood for suspense, right? Elizabeth Goddard. And then when I'm writing my novel, I don't like to read the same genre. So I read very widely, but I read a lot of fantasy, believe it or not. I love fantasy books. And so I will plow through, you know, the new fantasy things that are out. I just downloaded a couple new books. I'm listening to Words of Radiance right now from Brandon Sanderson on audio. So I really love, it's just a different world, right? And it's so foreign from my world. I don't have to worry about like, oh, am I pulling something from somebody else's book to put in mine, right? So I'm really aware of that, and I don't ever want to do something like that. And so then one of my tricks is just to not read that genre while I'm writing. So I do a lot of fantasy books and love them. I recently read Ronnie Kendig's Brand of Light and loved that. So, you know, it's like fantasy is really fun.
Yeah, and I guess unconsciously I've done the same thing, Susan, where I haven't, you know, really read romantic suspense while I'm working on writing a book. And I guess I didn't realize, because the same thing, I don't want to, you know, accidentally steal something because it's in my subconscious. And so, you know, this whole, you know, we're recording this in September, and the coronavirus pandemic is still going on. Has that impacted your time to write? I've talked to many writers, and sometimes it seems like it's been harder to write these last 6 months or so. Have you found that to be true, or things you're just chugging on like usual?
Well, actually, I found it to be even more productive, and here's why. I haven't done any traveling. So, I usually travel for, you know, many usually a couple weekends out of the month I'm traveling because I'm teaching at different conferences or I'm doing book events. And really, I've had 8 months of staying at home now. So it's just actually been quite lovely. I've written a couple extra books that I wouldn't have written, just, you know, that I worked into my schedule. I've been, you know, I write books on the side for fun. So I wrote a time travel series. And, you know, normally I wouldn't have time to work on that, but I did. And I just felt like it was a good way to sort of expand some of my other horizons. I started watercolor painting. Of course, we're remodeling our house by hand, so we do that all ourselves, and so we've been working on that. So actually, it was really a fun time to just be home. I mean, obviously, it's not fun for the world, and I do pray for people that are struggling with that. But, you know, for me, it was a opportunity to just hunker down and sort of get some stuff done personally that I have never had time to do because I travel so much. So it's been a really a kind of an interesting, almost super creative time for me.
So what is essential for you to write? I mean, do you have a special place in your house? Do you have like a little writer's shack out back?
Sure. Well, I've always had, our family travels a lot and we move around a lot. And so for many years I had an office when we lived up north in northern Minnesota. But since we moved down to the cities, Minneapolis area, we did the Magnolia thing where you buy the ugliest house in the neighborhood and then fix it up. So that's what we did. So I am just right now building my office, and we've been here for about 4 years. And so I travel with my laptop from sofa to chair to all these different other places. But for me, I just need a comfortable place. Like I have a big writing chair that I write in, or sometimes a sofa, and I put on music. I have my cup of coffee and I put on my earphones. And that's a big thing because my husband works from home. And he's in the same room. So I have to have earphones on, and I can find myself pretty immersed in a story. My biggest challenge is just to remind myself to get up and walk around, because I get so immersed into a story, I could sit there for 3 hours and just write and not necessarily move, and this is a bad thing. So I actually do have a little timer where I'll say, okay, I have to finish this scene by, you know, an hour, and then I have to get up and I have to move around for a few minutes and then go back in. But I can write. I like to write, though, and I can't spend like half of the day, you know, doing marketing and then writing. I have to have big, huge chunks of time. So what I do is I put all of my like admin stuff and marketing stuff on a Monday, and then I usually write all day Tuesday, all day Wednesday, and then the first half of Thursday, and then I teach Thursday afternoons or Thursday night at Novel Academy. So I, you know, always prep my lesson Thursday afternoon. And then Friday is a fun day for me, and I can write or I can do other things if I, you know, that housekeeping things, or sometimes I write my newsletter. So Friday's kind of a catch-all day. I'm going to write today after we get done talking, because I'm finishing up a novella. So it just is, so that way I can like sink into my writing time, and I don't have to worry about just other distractions. I don't do any appointments on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, just so that I can have a nice full day of writing.
Yeah, that sounds lovely.
Yeah, it is. It's great.
I'll try not to be jealous.
Yeah, it did take me a while to get here. I homeschooled my kids, so, you know, when they were younger, I would get, you know, they would be done by 1 or 2 in the afternoon, so I'd have, like, a good 4-hour chunk to write. But that was always harder because I was always, you know, trying to change up my time. And, you know, when the kids were young, I was bringing my computer to football games and basketball games or whatever. But now that I'm an empty nester, it's been great because I can really focus on my writing.
Yeah. Well, it has been lovely chatting with you, Susan, and we are out of time for today. So thank you for being on my show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been so fun. I'm glad we could chat.
You've been listening to this, The Romantic Side of Suspense. I've been talking with Susan May Warren. She's a USA Today bestselling author of more than 65 novels. And stay tuned for after this interview for an excerpt from her new book, The Price of Valor. Price of Valor.
Now an excerpt from The Price of Valor by Susan May Warren. Oh, how she hated herself for what she was about to do. The waitress walked away, and Sine blinked, drying her eyes, staring out at the street below. She spotted the man who had been talking to Ham emerge and head toward the Castello. Now, before any of his other cohorts showed up. She took a breath, turned. Ham sat in profile to her, wearing a pair of sunglasses, the sun beautiful in his hair, lifting golden threads from the brown. He hadn't shaved, so a hint of dark whiskers raked his face, and he wore a pair of cargo pants, flip-flops, and a button-down shirt. She walked up, pulled out a chair, and sat down. He just stared at her, unmoving. His mouth opened slightly. Then he closed it again and nodded.
"It was you I saw a couple months ago."
She nodded, her jaw tight. He drew in a breath, then looked away. And only then did she see it. The swallow. The slightest tremor of his chest. Unflappable Ham, biting back his emotions. Yeah, well, maybe seals didn't cry either. He drew in a long breath, and then he was back.
"How are you?"
She opened her mouth and didn't even know where to start, so...
"Is Aggie okay?"
"Yes. She's with family friends and she's safe. She misses you, though."
She looked away, refused to let his words lodge inside her. Although,
"Tell her I love her."
A pause.
"Sine,
why are you here?" She looked straight at him, seeing his eyes through his sunglasses. Good. Her voice hadn't started shaking.
"You're not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be meeting..."
"Roy, I know."
"What?
How do you know about Roy?"
He shook his head.
"It's a long story, and not for now, but..."
"I need to know, Ham. This is... There are people's lives at risk."
"I know you have the list."
His voice was low. She drew in a breath.
"Okay."
"And I know that your cover was blown at your last meet."
She frowned, but yes, he might know that if he'd talked to Roy. Or maybe Martin.
"Was Roy compromised?"
"He just said that you wouldn't trust him if you saw him, and you needed a friendly face."
He affected a smile. Friendly. That was a loaded word. But...
"I'm going to forgive her."
The waitress came over.
"Coffee?"
She nodded, just needing something to hold on to. The woman poured her a cup of thick espresso, set a pot of steaming water on the table for her to add to it.
"Croissant?"
"Yes, please."
Sine wrapped her hands around the warm cup, inhaled the aroma.
"What's going on, Sine? How did you get involved in this? And how is it that I have a 10-year-old daughter I didn't even know about?"
He didn't raise his voice. Didn't sound accusatory. But his question was a knife to her heart.
"You remember Pavel Sarnayev, right?"
"Yes, the Chechen warlord who attacked the refugee camp you were working at. The man who kidnapped you. And the man I thought the U.S. had killed with a missile strike to his bunker. The bunker you were in."
Only at the end did his voice strain, and she had a small hint of what it might have cost him to watch her die.
"We were out of the bunker by then. I wasn't hurt."
He let out a breath. It was well into the war in Afghanistan, and the CIA knew he had terrorist training camps. They wanted me to find out who was in those camps and what they had planned. I was supposed to act as an aid worker, establish assets, discover his network, work from the outside. But when Pavel attacked the camp, well, I changed the plan. He took off his glasses. His blue eyes could still hold her captive, especially when he asked, quietly,
"Bypassing the fact that you were in the CIA and didn't tell me, did you know you were pregnant?"
"No." She met his gaze and silently begged him not to ask if knowing would have made a difference, if she would have left, gone home with him, been his wife. Probably. She hoped so. But she'd been pretty idealistic back then. He didn't ask.
"How did Pavel Sarnaev get the knock list?"
She studied him. "How did you get this assignment?"
"Senator White asked me to meet you. He knew, given our history, that you might trust me."
He left that hanging there, a real question behind it. She wanted to. Of course she did. It was Ham. "Senator White is running for president, isn't he?" Ham nodded. "And his running mate is Senator Reba Jackson?"
"Yes, why?"
Right then, she could have told him. Could have revealed what she'd seen. What she'd heard. But she paused. Mostly because she didn't know how far into this Ham had gotten. Or if the powers that be intended to use him for something nefarious. But also because, behind Ham, Mount Etna began to shiver. She glanced at the black smoke billowing off the mountain. Ham turned.
"Oh my."
And that was as far as he got before the top came off the mountain.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.